Next year, annual premiums for Medicare prescription drug insurance are jumping an average of 31% in California, rising on average from $240 to over $300.
That may not seem like a lot to some beneficiaries.
Kevin Prindeville is a staff attorney at the National Senior Citizens Law Center in Oakland.
But for many low-income seniors who are on a fixed income, that kind of change can really make the difference between whether they can access medications or whether they can pay the rent or go grocery shopping that month.
Prindeville warns that if these seniors and other low-income Medicare recipients want to avoid these sharp premium increases, they need to shop for new plans right away. That's because they'll have fewer to choose from. He says that next year, the number of prescription drug policies that are fully subsidized by the federal government for low-income Medicare recipients will drop by half to 7.
That means that 600,000 low-income Californians will have to switch plans to avoid paying a premium next year. When large numbers of beneficiaries have to switch plans, there can often be problems. There can be computer delays and glitches. There can also be problems with beneficiaries being assigned into plans that don't cover the drugs that they need. So we're very concerned about this large population.
The health insurance industry says premium increases are due in part to rising drug costs. But consumer advocates say the premium increases don't necessarily mean better benefits. Christabel Chung is director of social services at the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program in San Francisco.
You would like to think that it enhances coverage as the premiums go up, but honestly, the premiums could range hundreds of dollars and be the exact same plan.
Mohit Ghose, spokesman for America's Health Insurance Providers, an industry trade group, says the total cost of the federal drug insurance program is running $113 billion below what the federal government had forecast over a 10-year period.
Plans are being ultra-competitive, pricing as well as they can in order to keep costs down for beneficiaries and for the federal government.
Chris Perrone of the California Healthcare Foundation says the Medicare drug coverage program, just 2 years old, is still volatile as the insurance market sorts out what policies to offer. He says consumers will vote with their feet.
Choice is good in this context. What's needed is assistance in helping beneficiaries sort through those choices.
That assistance is available online and through groups like Christabel Chung's Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program. It's booked solid for weeks to help seniors sort through the plans. Enrollees have until December 31st to make their decisions. For the California Report, I'm Marjorie Sun.
And finally today, a sixth-grade chess player from Foster City has won the world championship for the under-12 division. Daniel Noroditsky bested his peers at the World Youth Chess Championship in Turkey. When he's home, Daniel plays at the Mechanics Institute Library and Chess Club in San Francisco. That's the California Report for Thursday, November 29th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Myra. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.
Well, good evening. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, also www.kzyx.org on the World Wide Web, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting listener-supported community radio. The preceding portion of the California Report was brought to you by Ukiah Main Street Program, and we thank them very much. It's just about 7 o'clock and time for Education Now. Education Now is being brought to you tonight in part by our members and Electric Bikes of Willits, providing healthy climate, safe transportation for the path ahead at 630 South Main in Willits. Information at 459-2414. I'm your host, Athena Melville, for Education Now. Stay tuned. We're going to have some music first. Thank you.
the road.
You want to turn off that button.
Must have a code that she can live by.
Yeah.
And so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye.
Okay.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
Well, welcome to Education Now. I'm sorry I had my mic on while I was talking to my guest. Good evening. I'm your host, Athena Melville, and tonight on this special edition of Education Now, I welcome Professor Margot Porter to our KZYX and Z airwaves here in the Philo studio. Hello, Margot.
Hello, Athena.
Can you say that again, Margot?
Hello, Athena.
Hello. Dr. Porter teaches in the credentialing program for Sonoma State University, while she maintains a thriving third-grade classroom at the Ukiah Elementary Public Schools in Ukiah. So we want to welcome Margot to the show, and I know many teachers that you have mentored who just rave about your classes and your third-grade classroom, Margot. So you come just so highly recommended by everyone, I can't tell you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and first of all, I wanted to just dig right in and ask you how long you've been teaching for Sonoma State.
I've been working for Sonoma State in the credential program for 7 years.
All right. And how long have you had that fantastic third grade classroom I've heard so much about at Ukiah?
This is my 13th year with the third grade classroom.
Oh, how amazing. What a dedicated teacher. One of those dedicated teachers that David Elkind talked about. I so admire you. I want to jump in right away to what we promised on the promo, which is best practices. What are best practices? And the case study, could you please explain that to our listeners?
Best practices are simply the kinds of techniques and methods that are used in a classroom to achieve the goals that are set out for the students.
And what would you say are best practices? I mean,
best practices for me?
Yes.
It's a matter of using specific techniques, lessons, methods, materials that suit the students that you are currently working with.
So you're looking at each individual child when you're talking about best practices.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that difficult to do with no child left behind?
I have not found it to be a huge issue up until like right now. We've been very fortunate in our rural area to not have such a heavy hand put upon us in determining the kinds of methods and curricula that we use in a classroom. That might change in the near future, but we've still been able to maintain autonomy so that we can determine what it is that we need to do in order to be effective with our classroom and our students.
That's fantastic. I mean, hallelujah. And how many students are there in your classroom?
I have 20 students in my classroom.
That's wonderful, too. 20 students. I mean, that's not bad.
This is the result of the class size reduction program that was put in about 12, 13 years ago, and has, in my opinion, made a huge difference in terms of a teacher being able to be more individual with the students and be more more informal and more personal in being able to discover who they are and what it is that they need in order to be able to provide that facilitation that they need in order to move on in their learning.
Right. So you can focus on the process instead of the product. With that,
it's all process.
It's all process. Yes.
Yay! Products are things that you make in a factory when you have like raw materials and clay and you can kind of mold it around. We're talking about people, and
yes.
People are not products.
Yes, yes. Hear, hear. Isn't she fantastic? Is it 1 to 20 then? Do you have anyone in the classroom that helps you out, or?
I draw upon the Sonoma State program, and I always seem to have people coming through my classroom, and I've been very fortunate in having observers and student teachers who come in and work with me. So even though officially it's 1 to 20, there's always seems to be adults around that are out there to help out and give a hand.
That's right. That's wonderful. I know that they decreased the student faculty ratio for first graders, I remembered, about 12 years ago, but I hadn't realized that it had continued to affect the other grades as well.
Well, the official reduction for the state was K-3, if the district chose to participate in that. And so our district fortunately did and has continued to keep that ratio going. And I can only say good things about that and hope it continues in the future.
Yes, I certainly hope it continues in the future. I had one person who mentored with me, and she then was in the Calpella schools, and they reduced the ratio, and she was at first grade. And she was saying to me, "But Athena, even though they reduced the ratio, I can't really focus on the process." And so this is so wonderful to hear you say that you're not always teaching to the test.
Mm-hmm. First grade is a very different story than working with third grade. First graders are much needier, and they're 6 years old, and that's a big difference 2 years later, so that I have that advantage of those 2 years to
right.
work with. And you know, 20 may sound like a small number, but in many states, class size reduction actually means, you know, 14. So small class size in California is 20, 13 somewhere else. So it could be smaller, maybe better. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, multicultural studies, how do you deal with that in the current system? I've heard raves about your multicultural approach.
I don't actually, in my third grade classroom, I know this is one of my Sonoma State classes that I teach. In my third grade classroom, I don't teach a subject called multicultural education. Multiculturalism is really an embedded part of an outlook and the process of building the community and serving the diverse needs and the diverse backgrounds and ethnicities of the students that you have in front of you. So it's really hard for me to separate that out and say this is what I teach for multicultural, because it's a very personal approach. It's how you go about relating and building relationships in a classroom. We don't do holidays and heroes, you know, the Cesar Chavez Day. There's nothing wrong with that kind of acknowledgement of days, but it's not really what I consider an academically valuable piece of time, particularly in third grade. We do celebrations as a class, and we do things that I feel expand their awareness of different cultures. We do Chinese New Year, and we will do those kinds of celebrations. But, you know, in terms of the traditional Santa Claus kinds of things, I tend to downplay it. We're busy. We're mm-hmm. very busy. There's lots to do.
Do you? I've heard some wonderful stories about how you deal with Columbus Day and Thanksgiving, which mirror same book that I used to use. Do you do that with children as young as third grade, or is just that is that something that you're doing with in the credentialing program, but not something that you do in your classroom?
A lot of the material that we work with and discuss in the multicultural class with university students is way beyond an 8-year-old's ability to comprehend or
right.
to handle. And one of the things that I try to be very careful of is to be sure that I don't overwhelm students with my ideas. Certainly in older groups of students, I have in social studies approached these topics. With 8-year-olds, it's not appropriate. But what I do in terms of things like Halloween is I try to expand it beyond our typical American Halloween, and we do activities from Dia de los Muertos, and we make sugar skulls and discuss that kind of a celebration, which also, in terms of multicultural, relates to my Hispanic population in the classroom, too.
Yes. So do you have a diverse student body, do you feel?
I think our school is diverse in terms of our Caucasian population and the Hispanic population. But other than that, there's not a lot. There are a few Asian students and a few African American, but not to a huge degree.
Okay. And how about the arts? Do you find that it's not difficult at all to work the arts into your curriculum?
Not at all. I use a very integrated approach in my classroom. Out of necessity, there's so much to do. There are so many standards and so many academics, and the expectations, you know, of moving students along. That when you put that together with my own personal philosophy of wanting students to be able to have hands-on experiences and discovery kinds of activities, that the arts work in beautifully. With the social studies and the kinds of required topics and really are an extension for the students.
Yes, and how about things like drama and movement? Do you use drama in the classroom?
We use 8-year-olds are very dramatic.
Yes,
they are incredibly dramatic and humorous. We do a lot of readers' theater.
I find that Reader's Theater is
an incredibly positive and fun way to develop reading fluency with students in dialogue and in performing vocally for their peers. And we do a lot of music. As a matter of fact, we sing every day. I used to say it was for the students to get their endorphins up, but it's actually for me. We do it in the morning to wake myself up. And what's happened with that is the students have, on their own, developed little hand plays and kinds of movements that go along with the music, which is fine by me.
Yes, it sounds just beautiful, just wonderful. Now, how about parent involvement? Do you have parent involvement in with your students? Is that possible? Is it desirable?
It's necessary, absolutely necessary. I think that as educators, sometimes we get so involved in ourselves, the curriculum, the classroom, the activities, that we forget to say, thank you, Mom, thank you, Dad, for trusting me for 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, with the most precious, precious belonging that you have. And I try to remember to say thank you, because having my own children, I know that that is an incredible trust that's placed in me, and I truly thank them for that. In terms of parents physically being in the classroom, I think it's something we need to acknowledge, is that times are not the same as they were 40 years ago, and parents most of the parents in my experience are working parents, and their child's at school with me, and they're out earning a living and doing the jobs to provide for the family. So I don't have a lot of parent volunteers on a regular basis, but they are always there when I need them. I talk to them on the phone. I just finished parent conferences this week, and 100% of my parents showed up.
Congratulations.
And actually took the time out of their day to come talk to me about their child for 30 minutes. It was very, it made me feel really, really good.
Yes,
and I know
you
that
should.
That's a cost to some parents of actually losing their lunchtime. But parents support me in all the other ways that are important. They love their child. They dress them, you know, so that they're warm, and they give them their food, and they provide for them. And for that, I thank them, because what more could you ask for as a teacher than a
right.
child who's loved, been loved and cared for?
Right, that comes ready to learn.
Absolutely.
That has those basic needs, like met. Now, can there be peer teaching in the current system?
And do you mean child to child? Or
yes.
I think there's a lot of peer teaching in two respects. Definitely child to child. You know, students learn everything from each other. A lot of things we wouldn't like them to learn, but their whole socializing experience is with each other. And they will learn what's cool to wear and what's not cool to wear, how to say something that's cool, or, you know, they learn all that. So you would be really foolish to not use that relationship that's already there in the classroom to promote learning.
Right.
And so one of the things that I do in my classroom is I allow conversation, because that way when students need to work with each other, it's an okay thing to do.
To have dialogue.
You have to talk to each other. And plus they can ask each other instead of waiting for me. And I've discovered long ago, I don't always have all the answers they need, and I can't always say it the way they need it to be said to understand it. But the guy next to them can probably do that very well. So students are constantly working together.
Oh, that's so beautiful. That's just beautiful.
I would also like to say that in terms of peer learning, that the learning that goes on professionally from teacher to teacher to teacher is also really, really vital.
Yes, you've told me that. Whenever I say, I just heard such great things about you from your students, you say, oh, they've taught me more than I've, you know.
Well,
and I say, that's spoken like a really good teacher.
Well, it sometimes is amazing to me and real humbling to hear all these great things, because I do all these noble things. And the bottom line is really, it's a selfish endeavor, because I benefit from it.
Yeah, it brings you joy.
And knowledge.
Yes.
And it keeps me aware of what's going on around me, when it's so easy to get overwhelmed by day-to-day things in your classroom with your own, you know, third grade students. So I think that one of the joys I have in being able to get up every day and go to work and do the job that I do is that I work with people who are willing to share themselves and support each other. And there's so much to be learned from those adults that I work with that are a part of my daily professional life. And my favorite story is the time somebody said, you know, people just, you know, don't connect. Teachers never talk to other people or whatever. And so I ran this experiment, and I wanted to see how long it would be before I connected with an adult in school. So I just came to school, went to my room, whatever, and to see how long it would be before I connected with another adult, unless I actually went out and initiated it, and discovered that, in fact, it was 9 days.
9 days?
9 days. and that was only broken because a parent came into my classroom looking for somebody else's classroom, kind of thing. So you really need to go out and appreciate those people that are around you that are there, and so willing to be a part of your lives and let you be a part of theirs. Mm-hmm. So peers and teachers are there too.
Yes,
important.
That's true, and that's very good. So I suppose you've really answered all these questions when I say, I was thinking, how can teachers be creative and follow their own wisdom if they have to conform to a specific curriculum? And but you've pretty much answered that for me.
There are a lot of concerns that I continue to have. You know, I'm not a person who has a lot of answers, truly. I have a lot of questions, and the older I get, the more questions I have. And NCLB,
NCLB, for those of you, is No Child Left Behind.
Yes. It was great rhetoric, and it really draws on people's emotions, but the actual words and the actual interpretation of this legislation is creating some things that in many districts is making it very difficult for teachers to remain true to their beliefs and serve the students that they have. And in our area, we have so far been very lucky in terms of not having that happen to us. But, you know, in places where you have a they call them curriculum Nazis, who come in the classrooms with their clipboards to check mark that you have done things according to the text, and it would be very difficult, very difficult. But I know that in all of the really, really great teachers, and I've been around a lot of them, truly, it would be very difficult for them to give up that that sense of accomplishing what they need to do, that creative, that autonomy that they feel is so necessary, and I know is necessary to continue to do the job that needs to be done. And I have yet to find a program or some kind of a script that they would give me that would ever be able to replace that knowledge I have of my class and my, you know, each student and their ability to learn and being able to modify and create the things that need to be done to allow them to do to be successful.
To really direct their own learning, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, I pushed the cough button there.
Oh, thank you so much.
I pushed it for myself a moment ago. Yes, well, I was wondering, so you, over the time that you've had this classroom, like you said, 13 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have your class size was decreased 12 years ago, so after the first year, and since then you've had pretty much creative academic freedom in your classroom to follow all of your individual children and design a program that meets their needs and their learning style.
Right. All teachers have the state standards to follow, which I'm a veteran. I've been in education for 37 years now. And what I discovered when I first walked into a classroom as a novice teacher was that there were no standards and there were no textbooks. And it was very difficult, truly difficult, to know what it was that I should be doing. And when they started to bring in the standards, I found them to be very comforting in terms of knowing that students would come to me with some exposure to certain areas, and that after me they would go on to certain areas. And so standards were really, really great. I just embrace standards because they give me direction and focus.
Right.
And there's only so much time in a day to do absolutely everything. So then the next thing that follows are the textbooks and the adoptions and so forth. And most of the early adoptions tended to be very very open and so to modify and change things that needed to be changed or to expand in areas that students were really interested in exploring more, that has been very easy too. NCLB has kind of made an impact and continues to make an impact on the curriculum that's adopted, and it tends to be a lot more narrow and a lot more restrictive, it seems. And at this point in time, we've had that freedom, and I embrace autonomy. Autonomy is incredibly necessary right. for the classroom teacher, and curriculum. To my knowledge, the curriculum is you're always adapting something, mm-hmm. a little bit here or here or here, mm-hmm. and I really honestly don't know anybody who follows it to the T.
Right.
It would be, I've never seen it. I can't even right. imagine. I think it would be a very bad TV show. Is
right.
what it would be.
Do you remember the old CTBS test?
Yes, I remember that.
Now, I had used those, and I would use them for as an assessment. I got some counseling from a person at Willits High School who, you know, was an expert in the area, and she said, now, when you use these, you really should give the more challenging tests if you think a child is, you know, moving ahead, so that they're challenging, you know, to use them, you know, to an assessment, but also to challenge. And there was reading and science and history in mm-hmm. those tests.
Yes, I remember.
And critical thinking. And I really, you know, I didn't mind them at all. But I've heard that, you know, what I've seen with No Child Left Behind is I really question that there are standards. I mean, standards? I mean, that's the, you know, it's kind of standards with a question mark, kind of like the bar is set so low. Am I really misreading that, do you think, Margot?
I'm not sure what the bar is. And as a classroom teacher, I'm really totally in the dark about these tests. They're very secretive. And, you know, we don't get to look at them ahead of time, or we don't get to really examine, you know, the questions or responses or anything in there. So I'm not really sure how well-matched they are to standards. And because they're national tests and every state has different standards,
mm-hmm.
One has to wonder, well, whose do they match?
Yeah, whose do they match?
Yeah, and of course they have no answers for this. This is an ongoing debate that... Nobody's really responded well from the testing companies. The response is pretty nothing.
Pretty silent.
Very silent.
Very silent.
Very silent.
Well, it's just about 7:30, and so I think we're going to take a little music break here. This is KZYX&Z, and this is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now. We're here with Dr. Margot Porter, teaches at the credentialing program for Sonoma State and has had a third grade public school classroom in Ukiah at Ukiah Schools for over 13 years. And we're going to take this little music break and then we'll be back and we're going to open up the line. So if you'd like to call in, our phone numbers are 1-800-499-7117 or 895-2448. You can get ready for that. We'd love to take your calls. I checked out with Margot, and she's very open to it, too. So when we come back, we'll open up those lines. Right now, I'm going to give you a little, I'm going to give you a little scatting from the Muppets. Here we go.
Phenomena. 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 coming up.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that scatting from the Muppets. And it was great to made Marco laugh. I hope you got a chuckle out of it, too. So, once again, the numbers are 1-800-499-7117 or 895-2448 if you'd like to talk to Margot or to me here at the on Education Now. And we're talking to, I'm Athena Melville, and we're talking to Dr. Margot Porter about education, public education. And I wanted to go on, Margot, and ask you if you felt that if you felt that the administration was supportive of this best practices. And
I feel that the site administration has, in my experience, been enormously supportive of teachers doing the best job possible with the students in the school. I cannot speak for all sites or all situations, but I certainly have never felt that the administration was out to hurt children,
right?
Kind of thing.
I have said many, many times on this show, on air, and to other people that it's not the problems that there are in public education are not the teachers, not the administration, that it's coming from the federal government. At least that's the way that I see it. And that even in California, I think in the 80s, in 81, I mean, to that time, funding for education was much higher. And then with the tax cuts and things, there were changes. I could, at least in Huntington Beach where I was, there were the kind of significant changes with the cutting out of music and the arts and the increase in class size that... I just felt like a promise had been broken. And then, of course, having to pay to go to college was another thing, because college was free in California. You know? And we were second only to New York in terms of the public school system. And now we're down, I think, 47th or something.
I think it's 48.
48, right, nationally. And so you know that something has happened. But it's not the teachers, and it's not the administration, because I mean, there are so many fantastic teachers in the public system in Willits, where I raise my children. And, you know, my older boys, when they left and went on to public school, I just met wonderful people. Or when children would come to me from public school, there were teachers they just wouldn't miss. Now, so I just know that. I know that that's the case. And I was wondering if you had any ideas, if you felt that there was in some way that persons could help affect some changes for public school.
Well, first of all, I have to agree with you that the closer the job title, the teacher, the site administrator, and so on, the closer they are to the classroom and the student, the more supportive they are of best practices and things that work. And I think that a lot of the difficulties that we experience are coming from policymakers who are not involved in public education in their own personal life. People in Washington who are making decisions about, like the reauthorization of NCLB, these are people who are far removed from public education. in terms of experience. These are people who are not talking to teachers, but are listening to other policymakers, and probably have not had any experience in being in public schools themselves or in having their children in public schools. So they're looking at, well, they might see it as an objective viewpoint of schooling, but they are also looking at it without experience and without depth, and it's pretty cold. And so they're making policy that is ineffective, but punitive, as NCLB is. In terms of having people who want to try to affect some change, there are organizations that have been very active in slowing down the reauthorization so that it can be more carefully worded and more carefully examined. And parents who really want to get involved should perhaps contact these organizations and or contact their teachers and find out what organizations their local teachers might suggest for them. Because it's a letter or an email or a phone call. You do a lot, one person here, one person there. It builds up, and it's a lot. It falls on somebody's desk, and it's a lot. And it can be effective. And I think that NCLB was up for reauthorization in October, and there were some, instead of, fixing problems that existed, I believe that they made, they added a lot of things to it that made it even more of a problem piece of legislation. And there were a lot of teachers and organizations that began these phone calls and emails and letters in a campaign to say, please reconsider, look at this carefully, and we put out our voice. And it slowed it, and it did not get reauthorized.
Oh, hallelujah.
So I'm not a political person, and I know that sometimes you just have to be. And if parents really want to help a situation that could get much worse in the future, that would be my suggestion.
Great. Thank you for that. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Now, how about favorite books? Do you have favorite authors on children and child development? big smile here.
I have a California school librarian credential, and I got that not because there are elementary schools have librarians, because they don't, but I just loved children's literature.
Yes.
There's just so many authors out there that I wouldn't even know where to start. And I read all the time. So in terms of children's, just go into your local bookstore and just start picking up books and start reading, because there's so much out there. And children's literature isn't just for children. There are
right.
some incredibly intelligent, fabulous writers who are hiding in the children's book section.
Yes.
So I just, you can start anywhere with that.
Right.
In terms of...
I like to take the kids to the store and let them choose their books when they get older.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they just have... That was such a fun, a fun thing to do.
Well, yeah. And it's also valuable because they will really read what they...
choose to read.
And we need to trust them to be able to do that.
Yes.
Sometimes we keep making decisions for them, and that's not
right.
That's not cool.
No, I think it's great to follow them as much as we can. But about an adult, if an adult was interested in reading authors who are talk about child growth and development or education today in our country, or do you have some favorite books or writers on child growth and development or on education today that you might recommend?
Where to start? I absolutely adore Jonathan Kozol. He He is my favorite person. His books are incredibly informative and very readable. They paint a picture of American education that most of us don't want to see. And truly, in our beautiful area of the country, we really don't see what he has seen in his experience. But yeah, he's fabulous. As a matter of fact, he has a new one out, which are Letters to a First-Year Teacher, which it says everything you need to say about education today.
Letters to a First-Year Teacher,
and
not just for
first-year teachers, by the way.
But that's just the title.
Absolutely.
Right.
And so in anything else that you find with his name on it, it would be great. In terms of education and multicultural education, anything that's put out by Rethinking Schools, they are an incredible group of people who are unafraid to look at injustices and take it and provide lessons and resources so that you can actually take that into a classroom. If I were in middle school or high school at this point, they would just be absolutely everywhere in my classroom.
Rethinking Classrooms.
The organization is called Rethinking Schools. And you can find it on the internet, rethinkingschools.org. They have publications like Rethinking Columbus, Rethinking the Classroom, Rethinking Mathematics, and they also have a quarterly magazine that is worth, it's the cheapest subscription in the world. It's like $18.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth like a million. So
I think it's that Rethinking Schools that we used to use, where we would, on Columbus Day, we would arrange with a student and to pretend to steal their backpack.
Yes.
And then when we would come to Circle, I would say, "Oh, look what I discovered."
Right.
And just start taking things out and just being, and the kids would just be, "Oh, furious, that's so-and-so's backpack. How can you do that?" But of course, that so-and-so was in on it. And finally, we would say, "Well, how do you think Native people spelt?" And it made such an impact. One of my students then later went on to join the military and, you know, told me, "Athena, I just need the discipline." And I said, "I will support you," you know. And then he wrote me that he had done this on Columbus Day on board ship and arranged it with another of his friends, and that they loved it. And I was just so glad that he was carrying it on.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite lessons. And it was done by Bill Bigelow, who is one of the editors for Rethinking Schools.
Yes. And how about, do you know Zinn, Howard Zinn?
Howard Zinn, absolutely.
Right. I think he's wonderful, too, for junior high and high school.
Yeah, and James Lowen, Lies My Teacher Told Me.
Yes.
And he just came out with a new one, which is, he's gone around the United States looking at historical markers and statues and done an incredible critique of what these are presenting to people in terms of what's on them and how they're placed. And yeah, I'll never look at another roadside marker the same again.
And what's this person's name?
I believe it's James Lowen.
James Lowen. This sounds wonderful. Well, once again, it's we're here on Education Now with Dr. Margot Porter and talking about education. The numbers are 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. And I'm certainly enjoying it. It's exciting to me to know that there are, I've always known there are fabulous teachers in public education, but it's wonderful to have one highly recommended on air here on Education Now. Oh, we do have someone on line three. Let's call up that person. Here we go. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if there was anything we should be concerned about locally that we should be supporting politically. if there's anybody or any situations right now that we should be involved in or looking at.
So you want to know if there's any situations? Can you rephrase? Can you say that again?
Yes. As far as our public education goes, is there, where can we make a difference? Is there someone or something that we should be doing politically, or should our activism have its focus? Is that
okay? Did you get that, Margo?
Yes, I think
I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I think I understand her to be asking if there's any local organizations or issues that are needing support or any way that they can participate.
Right. You brought that up a little bit earlier when you said, you know, that you had a lot of parents came out and support when you guys needed it, when they were going to maybe adopt some reforms of the
NCLB.
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, on a local level, the strongest thing that people can do is to support their local schools and their teachers within those schools, and do that through, in terms of being a parent, through involvement with the classroom activities and being aware of what's going on within the school, perhaps being on committees or just keeping a conversation with people who are on these committees, like the school site council and the PTAs or PTOs, and being aware of the school boards and decisions that might be made. Minutes for the school boards are online, and you can skim and read those. And at the local level, I'm not sure that there's anything that is a huge issue at this point in time, but it might be to somebody else who may not know what's going on. So, you know, you just gotta make that little bit of effort to be aware, or easiest to connect with the people who are involved, and have them contact you if you want to participate.
Do you? I know one issue that comes up a lot, and people will write to me about or speak to me about, is this feeling that charter schools are taking money away from public schools.
Yes.
Have you heard that?
Oh, yeah.
And do you feel that charter schools are a detriment to... I mean, charter schools are public schools.
They are public schools.
They're not traditional.
Correct.
So, do you feel that there is a growing threat to traditional public schools by these charters? Is that a real concern, do you think?
I really don't have a lot of information. And so all I really have ever responded to on this is, what people say, back and forth to each other is basically it. I know that when students leave public schools and go to charter schools, that enrollment drops, and that affects the
ADA,
the average daily attendance amount that is given to the district through the state. But I really don't have super strong feelings for or against, because there are good teachers in charter schools who are doing incredible jobs, and and if the students are benefiting from this, I really don't know that that's a bad... I mean, I can't say that's a bad thing. It makes sense to me.
Right. So there, you don't feel that there's a war going on in the district about between these two factions, where if there was cooperation, maybe we could get further?
I think that charter schools have a lot more input and a lot more freedoms in terms of their methodologies in their classroom. And I think that perhaps as NCLB becomes more of a power and starts doing more of the punitive things that they have been threatening to do, I think charter schools might actually, there might be more, because they're not putting those punitive things are not
demands.
Really, demands are not necessarily hitting them, although charter schools do, in fact, do the testing.
Right.
So they seem to do a little bit.
When you
better.
Say punitive demands, can you give me some examples?
Becoming an improvement school is pretty horrendous process where, you know, the teachers have to undergo tons and tons of training, and where the, you know, the principals have to follow certain guidelines in terms of what they have to demand of their staff, and there's a set of rules about, you know, first year you have to do something here, and then you have second year something here, and it becomes very demoralizing and not a happy place to be.
That wouldn't be a happy place to be.
No.
Thank you. And this is the area where you said through emails and communication you guys managed to keep them from being able to establish these rules.
Certainly teachers throughout the United States and parent supporters and so forth managed to make an impact that, you know, we want you to listen. So and again, there are so many organizations out there that I hesitate to even say one over the other, but if you talk to your local teacher,
right,
they will be sure to give you information.
Right, and I would think if you Googled NC, you know, Child Left Behind,
yeah,
NCLB, that you would get a lot of information and you could follow it from there. And well, you know, the organizations that I could give you would not be supportive at all of NCLB. So that, you know, and would probably, I know Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood and the Alliance for Childhood are just irate with No Child Left Behind, mostly because it's really where the effects of it, where the really truly negative effects of it are hitting those children that Jonathan Cozzal writes about.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. The bad situation that these children were in to begin with is just being exacerbated to no end. And
right.
Certainly, I think the Children's Defense Fund would have something to say about that. They're the group that they stole the No Child Left Behind moniker from. so it was like, not sure there was much original in that document.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, we're just about running out of time with our guest here. But once again, the phone lines are open. It's 1-800-499-7117 or 895-2448 if you'd like to squeeze in here. I'm going to ask you for some contact information. Do you want to give out contact information?
That'd be fine.
So you want to give out your email address?
Email would be fine. The district one would be good. mporter@uusd.net.
mporter@uusd.net.
Yes.
Is that the one?
Yes.
That's one we'll give out. So there's Margo's contact information if you'd like to get a hold of her. And I just can't thank you enough for coming into the studio tonight.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I was nervous, but you make it very easy to talk about the things that are close to my heart. So thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you make it just so easy to have here. It's just been a super pleasure. And I know that so many people were looking forward to tonight, and I'm sure that they're just enjoying it no end and just don't have any questions. But I heard from a lot of people that they were just delighted that you were going to be on this show, and I heard from a lot of other people saying, I'm so glad you're going to have someone on from public school. And I thought, gee, I've done a lot on public school, but can't, oh, there's another call. Shall we take it?
Sure.
Here we go. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks. This is David Willis.
Hi, David.
I just want to pass on, last night in the middle of the night on KMOD, I heard an incredible alternativeradio.org show, and it was a public health doctor from Seattle, and he had a complicated name, and I can't see, so I couldn't retain it, but I did retain the name of his book, and his talk was called, Is America Driving You Crazy? but it's mostly about what we're doing to our children.
Mm-hmm.
And the statistics are incredible, and it's easy to get. Y'all know alternative radio, probably.
Yes, I do.
Barsamia.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm going to get a copy of it. It is so important, and this is a great show. And
thank you.
And so keep it up. But yeah, I wanted to pass that on. I wish I knew the name, but
well, thank you. We get alternative radio here on Wednesday afternoons at 1 o'clock, so
yes.
I'm sure it will come our way. But
yeah,
there is a lot coming down on children, and I think that Margo made a great point that here in Mendocino County, our kids have it really pretty great.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but you know, in the rest of the world, there are so many kids who don't.
Yes, and if we want things to go right, we have to care about all of them.
That's right. We have to care about all of them.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling in.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, that was good. Do you have any comments, Margo?
He makes an absolute, you know, excellent point that we do. We have to care about everyone. And we also need to look into the future and realize that so we're doing okay, you know, now. What's going to happen in a few years? What impact is what's happening now in classrooms that are being closed down to ideas and choice and positive relationships with the students? What's going to happen to that group of students as they move on through the schools and reach high school? And I kind of wonder, you know, is this concern we're suddenly hearing about high school dropouts a sort of a suggestion of what's to come in the future?
Right, a precursor.
Precursor, yeah.
Right. Well, thank you so much for coming in, Margo. It's just been my total pleasure. And the time just flew by. Looky there.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So there you have Margo Porter. I'm going to let her go, and I'm going to fill you in with some other information. I want to thank... Oh, we have another call, it looks like. Oh, shall we try it, Margo? Let's go ahead. Okay, caller, we're going to take you. Hello?
Hey, okay, I'm back. Hello?
Hello.
And what comment was that what we're talking about for others is they're having a real trouble with the students.
Caller?
Hello?
Caller, you're breaking up. I don't know if it's because you're on a cell phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. How is that now?
It's better.
Okay, so the university professors are having a bit of a problem because the students now are demanding, just tell us what you want us to know for the test. They're having a real hard time actually learning.
Yes, this is probably the case. What do you think?
Well, I have to agree that when everything is boiled down to black and white answers and fill in the blank, that over the years, people are going to want to fill in the blanks and to be expected to do much more than that, like actually think, might be a very traumatic kind of experience.
Now, is that horrifying or what?
it could become very, very scary because thinking is not something that... occurs without practice and experience and opportunities, and if we deny those, then we're actually saying that thinking really doesn't matter.
The most important thing I do believe in early education is to keep the curiosity, that child wanting to know, that child wanting to experience and learn.
You're absolutely right. We have to go because it's top of the hour, but thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again, Margo.
Thank you.
Well, everyone, this is KZYX, and tonight's Education Now with Margo Porter was brought to you in part by our members and Electric Bikes of Willits, which we thank them very, very much. The Boonville Big Band is playing Saturday, December 1st at Lawrence Cafe in Boonville. I think it's Bash is starting at... dinner's going to be served from 5 to 9, but they'll be on after 9, I think. And That's about all we have time for. Stay tuned for Earth and Sky right here at 8 o'clock. And then WDAN with the Treehouse will bring you some laughter and fun. So good night from Education Now Special Edition. And have a good holiday, everyone. Let's get that Earth and Sky going. There it is. Here we go. I could put some music on, I suppose, but, you know, let's see. There's the 29th right there, and we're going to turn the dat on and up, and I'm going to say good night, everyone.
Earth and Sky.
Scientists at Purdue have found that tropical cyclones, which can become Atlantic hurricanes, cause strong feedbacks between Earth's oceans and atmosphere.
In other words, ocean temperatures might affect the intensity of tropical cyclones and hurricanes, which in turn affect ocean temperatures and circulation. This result supports an earlier, very controversial study suggesting that global warming will cause stronger hurricanes. Earth and Sky spoke to Matthew Huber of Purdue, co-author of the Tropical Cyclone Study.
So what we've shown is that over the past